Welcome to the Architectural History Podcast, a podcast dealing with histories of architecture in the built environment. In our first series, Architecture And, we speak to a number of academics, architects, writers and thinkers to discuss space, buildings and cities, and to think through contemporary debates and issues. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Jess. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. So we're back. We're back with architecture and faith this time.
Very exciting. And you know, I don't want to lower the tone right from the beginning, but I can't hear that without hearing the George Michael song. So this was your idea, Matt, to talk about architecture and faith. Tell us a bit about how you came to this.
Yeah, of course. So obviously, architecture and faith, the architecture of religious buildings, has always been a really important part of architectural history, going all the way back through time. Big status buildings built for religious purposes have always been at the center of human communities. And what I wanted to do was to talk to some researchers, academics, architects, and people in heritage who are tackling some of the specific problems and questions around what it means to deal with religious buildings in the 21st century Britain, but also who are bringing new approaches and thinking in fresh ways about what these buildings actually mean to the communities that use them. So I was extremely glad to be joined by William White, who's a historian of social and architectural history at the University of Oxford, to talk a little bit about 19th century church building and the Victorian church, and then also to be joined by Shahid Salim, who has written the kind of definitive history of the mosque in Britain and also is a practicing architect who's worked on mosques and worked at adapting buildings into mosques, and wanted to talk to him about the history of the mosque in Britain and what specifically those buildings mean to the communities they serve. And then lastly, joined as well by Rachel Morley, who's the director of a charity called Friends of Friendless Churches, which looks after over 50 church buildings that are no longer used by religious communities all over Britain, usually in rural or remote places where there aren't communities to support those churches anymore. And the charity tries to look after them and ensure that they maintain a piece of religious and architectural heritage. So three very interesting perspectives on the questions about what it means to combine together the social force of religion and faith with architecture and the built environment.
I'm excited to hear it. Such a range of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're starting off with William, who, as I said, is talking about the church in 19th century Britain and the changes that happened in that context. William, you've done a lot of research work on the history of the church in Victorian Britain. I guess, what do you think the benefit is of approaching history through buildings like churches? Why is that a fruitful way to approach writing about the history of the 19th century?
I think it's helpful in two ways. I mean, one is just that there's a problem there. The vast number of these things, the church is, you know, the 19th century is the great age of church building in British history. I mean, more churches are built then in quicker period than any other time in British history. So that by the 1860s, let's say, you know, there's a new Anglican church consecrated every 4 or 5 days, and the other denominations are building even more. So here we've got a question: why is this happening? What's going on here? Why are they building this? I think the other thing about it is that church buildings are inherently communicative. They tell us something about the people who are building them, about why they're building them, about what they hope they'll achieve by building. And that, in a sense, if you can unlock that, if you can get close to understanding why these churches are being built, why they look as they do, how they were used, and whether they achieved the goals that the people behind them were seeking to achieve, then that will tell you something huge about the buildings and those involved, but also about the wider society that they're a product of.
I mean, obviously that's a very big question, but why were they building so many churches, and why were the churches the way that they were?
Well, I mean, they're being built for all sorts of reasons because so many people are building them. There are so many different motivations behind each one. And, you know, each church, each chapel, each place of worship has its own particular story. But I think largely there are three reasons that they're building. I mean, some of them are purely practical. The first one is that the population is growing enormously. It's also condensing. So the 19th century sees Britain experience a population boom, like of which it'd never seen before, and also a concentration of that population into urban environments. And so by 1851, famously, Britain has become the most urban society that has ever existed. And that requires new facilities. It requires new buildings. It particularly people from the churches and from the state, actually, are very anxious about the fact that there just aren't enough churches, that they're not big enough, and that they're not in the right place. I think the second reason is that the 19th century also sees huge denominational competition. So that what you're seeing is churches trying to outbuild each other. You know, 1862 sees the anniversary of the expulsion of the nonconformists from the Church of England. And the dissenters, as they're called, they are building hugely to commemorate that. But the Anglicans say, well, we must make sure that there are two churches built for every nonconformist conventicle that's built at this period. It's wonderful exchanges. If you go through the archives of the Incorporated Church Building Society in Lambeth Palace, brilliant exchanges there, like the vicar in Aldershot who writes in and says, you know, the Methodists have just built a church for £4,000 and all the better a sort of Aldershot are now attending that church. And so the Incorporated Church Building Society sends him £4,500, which enables him to build a bigger church with a spire to lure back the better sort of Aldershot. So there's practicality, there's population, there's denomination. I think the third reason, and this is perhaps most interesting, is that I think there's also a change in how these buildings are understood. How they're understood and experienced, so that there becomes a strong sense that buildings actually do something, that it isn't just that you're providing places for people to worship, it's that in some way the provision of buildings and the furnishing of buildings and the decoration of these buildings, that in some way that's communicating something, that it's also helping to bring people to religion, that in a sense these become what Mary Carruthers has called, you know, engines of faith. These have working parts. And so that changing understanding of the nature of architecture changes the motivations for why you're building and also changes the form that you're building with.
Yes. I mean, it's always a very difficult exercise to try and uncover or reconstruct the way that people in the past understood things. It's a sort of great historical difficulty. How do you go about trying to reconstruct those understandings of architecture?
Well, yes, I mean, it's a really good question. And I mean, fundamentally, of course, it's impossible. I mean, in the same way that, you know, we're talking about here, particularly faith is such an intensely subjective question that, I mean, I don't think we have any real understanding of what people actually believe now. We probably don't have a very strong sense of what we ourselves actually believe now. So, you know, in a sense, trying to go back and do it in the past is a problem. But I think it can be dealt with. And I think there are, you know, largely what I've tried to do is to bring together the buildings themselves with texts that are written about these buildings. I mean, in a sense, just looking at the buildings can tell you a lot. There's clearly a change in sensibility. There's a move, I mean, most obvious in some respects, in change in style that churches experience in the 19th century. And so there's a widespread, not universal, but widespread rejection of classicism in favor of the Gothic revival, which is in itself an interesting question. But also, those new Gothic revival churches are filled with imagery. They're filled with color. They are organized in different ways. They sound different. They feel different from the 18th century church. And in a way, studying the experience of being in those churches and the experience of designing those churches gives you a clue to, you know, the sense of what these people are trying to do, and that they are trying to do something very different from what their predecessors were trying to do. And they're doing that very self-consciously.
I guess there is a problem there sometimes in trying to reconstruct how people experience these churches based on their architecture and the building itself, which is that quite often they don't look today how they looked then. And I was wondering if you had any reflections on the way that society and the material embodiment of this religious faith has been changed, shifted, mucked around with in some ways.
I mean, there is more or less transformative change that some of these churches have experienced. I mean, some of these churches in recent years, of course, have sought very self-consciously to undo the Victorian church. And so there's been a process of ripping out Victorian church fittings, of attempting to, I mean, you know, attempting to, as they see it, to undo what the Victorian church did. G. Street, the great church architect, was very condemnatory about the idea that comfort, mere comfort, as he put it, had any place in a church. These were serious places, and a bit of discomfort was good for you. Well, I mean, that goes against everything that the modern church wants to do. So some have experienced quite radical changes. Others, and I suppose this is even more interesting, is that other churches came to embrace some of these ideas of the 1830s, 1840s, but a century later. There's a sort of general process by which actually the churches that we look at now often look more advanced. They often include more things than they would have done in the 1830s or 1840s. I mean, there's a clear process in which, I mean, the church way of putting it is people move up the candle. Is that, as it were, what you do is you become more and more ritualist, and that what one has to do is get back to a kind of pre-ritualist thing. Both of those attitudes, though, I would argue, grow out of this fundamental, I mean, what amounts to a kind of paradigm shift in the 1830s, 1840s, because both the attempt to add more and more elaboration, to make the church more and more this kind of vehicle of communication, this engine of emotion, and the more recent attempts to get rid of all that, both of them grow out of the same basic intuition that's developed at the start of the 19th century, which is that if only we get the buildings right, people will come to church. If only we get the buildings right, then people will understand what the Christian faith is. And in a way, that's not an argument that's being made in the 18th century. So there's an odd way in which, even as you're going into a church and you can see that everything that was Victorian has been ripped out and replaced by comfy chairs and scatter cushions and carpets and kitchens. And you know, what you have is people who are saying, isn't it marvelous? This is a modern church and it doesn't do any of the things that the Victorians did. Nonetheless, they say they've done that because they believe once they've done that, the church will be attractive enough to lure people back to faith. So that basic intuition that if you get the building right, people will believe, has never gone away.
And it's a building that exists in a complicated, changing context, isn't it? You pointed out at the beginning that a lot of these churches were being built as a result of population change, kind of practically being built in the growing cities of Victorian Britain. The reality is that that populations change, communities change, the buildings are still there, but they're operating in a changing social context, often one very different to that envisaged by the people that were building the churches.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's often a sort of sense that people have that somehow this didn't work, that the Victorians built all these churches and people didn't go. Well, in truth, they built all these churches and people did go, but as you say, by the time they were built, it was often the case that the population had moved or that trends had changed. I mean, so what we've seen in the 20th century is a massive program of church closing. And it's a program of church closing that owes as much to population change as it does to anything else. It's a program of church closing, particularly amongst the free churches, which is as much to do with the fact that denominational competition has declined, that Methodist reunion in particular meant that you no longer needed three rival Methodist chapels in the same town, that they could have one Methodist Church and get together. So yes, I mean, those things change, and what you're left with is you're left with the material remains of a moment. I mean, it's like all architecture, is that architecture captures a moment. And then you have the question, what happens once that moment's passed? And I suppose that's the other thing that I think the Victorians are important for, is that at the same time that they are saying that these buildings have a kind of spiritual purpose, that they have a capacity to persuade people to come to faith, they're also developing a sense that these are works of art. That in some senses, these are buildings that are worth preserving in their own right because they're beautiful or important, or particularly because they embody a particular moment in time, a particular style, or a particular quality. And so what you get in the 20th century is a tension which emerges from the church's need, the institutional church's need to have buildings that work, and other people's want to preserve the buildings as they were constructed. You get a tension between this desire to close churches and other people's desire to preserve them, not because they're religious spaces, but because they are important aesthetic and artistic and historic spaces. And so some of the most interesting tensions of the current moment are precisely about that, which is the question of what are churches for now? What are they for? Are they doing what the church wants them to do, which is to attract people to faith? Are they doing what a lot of heritage bodies want, which is to preserve something which is beautiful and historically significant? And how do you square that circle is the really big question of the moment, particularly as we come out of lockdown, as we see, you know, churches which have spent the best part, religious communities which have spent the best part of a year meeting online. What are they going to do with these expensive, often difficult, sometimes beautiful, but nonetheless not always fit for purpose structures? And how do we support them so that they come to understand that these are useful to them as well as beautiful?
Amazing sort of display of William's knowledge of that period and the sort of huge amount of building that happened. One of the things that he mentioned that really jumped out for me was the importance of experience in these spaces, and how is it possible, perhaps it's impossible, to recreate that experience. But it really then helps us think about how we sort of experience spaces today. It just made me think about how I feel if I go into a religious space. So I thought that was fascinating. It's sort of historical imagination, isn't it? Sort of going yes. back and trying to think about how people felt when they were there. And I just also think the ideas about the self-consciousness of the buildings were really interesting. And I think that kind of links into what Shahid is going to talk about. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So next we're joined by Shahid Salim, who, as I said at the beginning, is a practicing architect, but also has written the first sort of definitive history of the mosque in Britain. And through his work in architectural practice and also his work as a historian and a researcher, has this very compelling story to tell about the way that Muslim communities interact with their architecture, the way they act as adapting buildings that weren't built for that purpose, and the way that they shape and capture and reform and create these very moving religious spaces through their own communal action and decision-making. How do you start to approach writing a history of the mosque in Britain, which, as you rightly point out, has been a sort of neglected subject within architectural history?
I had to start really just by looking at trying to find out what is there and doing sort of as broad a survey as possible through desk-based online sources, just to get a picture of the types of buildings that exist, the numbers that there are, where they are, because there isn't an overall database for mosques in Britain, as for probably, well, many religious denominations, I think, because there's no single overarching authority that organises or directs mosque building. So they are all autonomous grassroots community buildings that people start on their own in their own areas. So it was a question of whatever databases I could find, online sources, aerial photographs, and just to build up a library of mosque buildings and then start to sift through them, really, and to see what types of buildings were emerging.
Mm. And I guess one of the things that you highlight in your work, as compared to, for example, the churches that we were talking about with William, because of these kind of informal processes of setting up mosques, it's quite rare early on that they are in their own purpose-built buildings, right? And you also practice as an architect. How do you think about that process of a religious institution existing in a building that isn't necessarily originally intended for it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing that I think probably fascinated me from the outset, was that my experience of mosques, you know, from an early age, using them and then later coming on to sort of start designing them, was that, you know, the mosque was a kind of awkward type of space within an existing building. So, you know, often it would be in a house, for example, an adapted converted house. The earlier sort of mosques were in often converted houses. So, you know, you find that you're in this domestic space, which is a very familiar domestic space, front rooms, bedrooms, you know, bathrooms, and the walls have been knocked together, taken down, and rooms have been knocked together. And often what you're doing is, because the angle, the direction of prayer is towards Mecca, so there's a very specific sort of geography to a mosque. That's more, you know, more often than not at a funny angle in the building. So you find that you're sort of standing up in rows, at this kind of awkward angle, squeezed into like these little rooms, overspilling into corridors. Often, you know, people will be praying on stairs, for example. So you find you kind of trying to perform these kind of rituals on a staircase. So all this kind of, you know, a gymnastics that one is going through to be able to sort of perform the prayer within these existing buildings. And I think for me, that was always a really sort of curious and sort of fascinating experience. So I think that is the kind of enduring experience, I think, of the mosque in Britain and in sort of diaspora societies, that it is this largely a adapted building type. And, you know, for me, again, working with mosque architecture, most of the buildings that I've worked on have been within adapted buildings again. So there's very much a process of improvisation. You know, you have a space that you have to work with, and it's about within that space negotiating this whole other type of use within the kind of site that you have and the building type you have. You may be extending it, internal alterations, adding something on, you know, making changes, and trying to accommodate the needs of a community and a congregation, which are usually growing and also evolving. So the congregation doesn't necessarily know exactly what they want yet, because it's a new community. So they know that they want prayer space, but they don't know whether they want classrooms for children's education, or whether they want, you know, computer class for adults, or and so on. So it's very much kind of an evolving type. And, you know, what you find now in the last year with the pandemic is mosques being used for, you know, vaccinations or testing, or sort of communicating information about, you know, the pandemic and so on and so on. So many mosques taking on this kind of public role. So it's a program that's constantly shifting, actually. And I find that really quite fascinating, that you know, the kind of sensibility is that we have to make all of this work within an existing space. So it's a very sort of embedded, sort of ingrained activity, and it's ingrained within the existing city and existing townscape, the kind of act of mosque making, actually.
Mm. Are there any particular examples that you've worked on or researched or looked into the history of? You know, tell us something about the history of the mosque in Britain in particular.
There's probably no single example, I guess. But I suppose that's kind of obvious answer, because there's no really single example of any building type, really. But I think there are certain types that are almost characteristic. So, you know, in my work, I identified three or four kind of broad typologies. One was the kind of adapted house, so the kind of house that has been converted into a mosque. And that's a kind of archetypal religious space, I think, and, you know, throughout religious history, houses have been used as places of worship. So the act of kind of mosques being formed in houses is nothing new. It's something that's kind of age old. So that forms one particular typology Then you'll find all kinds of other buildings adapted, you know, pubs or shops or warehouses or banks and cinemas, all kinds of things which have also been sort of adapted into mosques. And then you get the purpose-built types where it's sort of built from scratch and it's much more intentional. With each one, there's probably a sort of archetypal, you know, this great, this typical form or this typical example which sort of encapsulates the whole, the story of that. One of the sort of adapted churches that I really enjoyed was in Didsbury in Manchester. I think it was in the late 19th century, you know, quite a large Victorian red brick church. And it had been adapted to the mosque around the sort of early 2000s. But it was a beautiful, you know, the internal space was very well retained. So you could, all the church features were there and enhanced and refurbished, you know, this wonderful sort of vaulted ceilings. And even the pew of the church had been used as the mimbar for the mosque, for example. So the kind of elements of the church had been reused. And, you know, the only change really is that the floor had been cleared and a carpet had been laid. And other than that, it had been refurbished to a really sort of... and also one of the rose window had been changed to have a sort of slightly more Islamic, but stained glass Islamic sort of insert placed into it. So with that building, you could really read the church architecture being celebrated and the new mosque use being celebrated. And that was a really successful blend of these two types.
One of the really interesting sort of key point that you've outlined is that regardless of the building type or the nature of the conversion or something, these are buildings that are very firmly grounded in the communities that use them. What are the kind of different priorities within communities that assert themselves in the construction of and the adaptation of mosque buildings within the UK? How have you seen those played out, both as a historian and as a practicing architect as well?
From an architectural point of view, people have come to me and asked me to work on their mosque buildings, whether it be extending or in certain cases kind of rebuilding as new. The main criteria has always been space. It's always been we need as large a prayer hall as possible. You know, the building that we have isn't big enough. We need to extend it. We need, you know, as much prayer space to the sort of sacrifice of architectural space almost. So I often say, well, you know, if you have a double height space here, you can create a much more sort of dramatic or enjoyable or kind of, you know, spiritual space almost. But it's really not, it just hasn't been an issue. It hasn't been a criteria. So people are more than willing to say, actually, we just need a single story room, you know, a single height room as our main pro, because we need to get another floor on top because we need to get that many people in. So, you know, if we pull back the floor above, we're just going to lose space. It's obviously frustrating from an architectural point of view, because one is always trying to create something which has some kind of drama to it, but it's not a priority. And, you know, no mosque has ever come to me and said, we want a sacred space, or we want a spiritual space, or we want a space that feels uplifting or enlightening or religious or anything like that. There are almost terms that people don't use. It's very much about functionality. You know, we need X amount of floor space because this is how many people get in. We need this number of classrooms. We need this number of ablution facilities. It all needs to be functional. The flow needs to work. They're very, in a way, utilitarian requirements for the performance of worship.
And I know you've spoken before about, for example, the mosque in Regent's Park. How does that process work in terms of when communities commission a building from scratch, rather than thinking about how to adapt a building into a mosque? How does that process of an architect working with a community to build something from scratch generally tend to work through?
I think that's an interesting shift in the way in which mosques are then conceived. Because although I'm saying that, you know, the primary requirements are for space and they're quite utilitarian for kind of performance of prayer, I'm not being entirely sort of honest in that, because actually those communities do still want a certain amount of visual symbolism and kind of visual recognition on those buildings. So even on adapted buildings, you'll find that people, congregations and communities do want to sort of resignify those buildings as mosques in some ways, even if it's something simple as putting arched motifs on windows of an existing building, for example. It's still important for people to do that, to be able to denote this as now a religious space and a sacred space of some sort, even though there's no formal sanctification process for mosques. People do still take on a sacred significance for communities and for congregations. When the purpose-built mosque comes into play, what I find interesting is that there's a shift from the process of improvising and adapting and sort of adapting as you go along and making decisions, design decisions as you go along. We have to be more intentional. You have to sort of make a plan beforehand and say, this is what we want the building to be. So there's a whole different process of projecting that goes on with communities.
So that was so interesting to hear Shahid talk about the differences between the sort of ad hoc conversion of spaces and how people have to be really quite inventive in how to make spaces work for them, to then that idea of still wanting to project outwards, wanting the building to look like a mosque from the outside in order to project into the community. I just really liked how those two things happen in parallel in the same spaces sometimes, to just show that kind of complexity of what's going on often in how buildings are used and designed.
Absolutely. And I think there's a thread that runs through all of these conversations, which is that buildings stay where they are. Buildings are kind of lasting, have a very long life. And often the society and the communities that those buildings were built for changes over time. And our last contributor, Rachel Morley, who's the director of Friends of Friendless Churches, a charity that looks after churches that are no longer used for religious purposes, has some very interesting perspectives as well about what we need to do with religious buildings and the architecture of faith when it no longer directly serves religious communities, because places that used to have lots of people living in them don't have so many people living there anymore, and what that means for our relationship to our material culture and heritage.
We are a charity that was set up in 1957, and we protect places of worship that are threatened with decay, demolition, or unsympathetic conversion, and we campaign for them, we repair them, we rescue them. And we've been doing that since 1957, and we have 58 buildings in our care at the moment. We work all across England and Wales.
So I know it's wrong to ask you to pick favourites, but are there any churches that you just, you know, when it's coming round, you've got to go and visit them again? You just find yourself thinking, oh, I'm so excited to go back.
Yes, I shouldn't choose favourites, because as well, we have volunteers around all of these churches, and I think they'd be so cross if they thought I was choosing another church over theirs. But I think for me, there's always just one, and it's in Carnarvon, or just outside Carnarvon in North Wales. It's St Baglan's Llanfaglan, and it is on the Menai Street. So it's kind of, you know, the field that the church is in is washed by the tide. It's in the shadow of Snowdon. And it's just such an ancient site. And I kind of think, for me, this church embodies so much about why the Friends of Friendless Churches do what they do. So it's a prehistoric site. There's been a community on this site, you know, for, you know, thousands of years, and you can see kind of how you can see the evolution of how the site was used within the boundary, the kind of ancient well, the holy well, just outside it, the medieval fishing trap, and within the building itself, and how some of the church was rebuilt using stone from Carnarvon Castle when that was sacked. So I think it just embodies so much of what we do, but it's also incredibly isolated and hasn't had a community for a very, very long time.
Mm. So as we've kind of already talked in the episode, buildings physically exist and continue to be in a space when often the society, the communities that surround it and use it change and people move. I guess your work to a large extent is about trying to preserve those buildings against these kinds of changes. What problems does that pose? I imagine some quite significant problems sometimes.
Well, it does. And I just wanted to pick up on something that William said, which I thought was exactly right, because he said one of the reasons for the kind of the big boom in church building in the 19th century was because population was growing, but condensing in different areas. And I think one study at the moment has said that there's 9% of churches are in places where only 0.33% of where the population are. And when there are 16,000 churches across England alone, you know, that becomes quite significant, really. So the population just aren't really around these places anymore. But my question is, if a building has been there for hundreds of years and it has been a sacred space, and even if it doesn't have a kind of an active community worshipping there, does the building kind of lose its importance? I think the building is inherently important to that place. And we hear a lot at the moment about placemaking. And I kind of think, you know, well, a lot of these places popped up around these churches and these settlements. And that is why these places should be protected. I'm really interested in all of this conversation, really, because it's kind of thrown up a lot of things for me to think about. Because I think when you think about funding for churches and places of worship, it's always about community value, community engagement, public benefit. And I don't have communities to engage. And I kind of think, you know, well, is this place not important? Because there's nobody here right now, even if there has been people there for hundreds of years. And we know that, you know, people come and go, things ebb and flow. And, you know, who knows that in 100 years' time, there might be a community there that may not want to worship there, but that may value that building. And I worry about the short-sightedness of many of the decisions around churches at the moment.
You sort of mentioned there some of the problems with some of the current approach and practice. Are there any examples that you think of a really good approach to questions of conversion, maybe, or of different uses for church buildings, or just generally, like, what are the kind of approaches that you and the friends would advocate when it comes to church buildings that are currently underutilized or facing financial difficulty or whatever it might be, these kind of problems?
Yeah, no, those are all really good questions. I'll try and pick up as many of them as I can, really. I do have issues around, you know, churches and places of worship, I think, are they don't get the financial support that they should, really. I think, and an example of that is the Heritage Lottery Fund, as it was in 2017, it shut down its dedicated stream of worship for dedicated stream of funding for places of worship without any consultation, and that was really a lifeline for places of worship. And without that, they're kind of in the mix with lots of other historic buildings and kind of heritage sites. But I think as well that for me, I feel that these churches kind of in competition with all of these other places, that, you know, they don't have the resources in many cases. So, you know, these are kind of, these could be rural churches that they just need to kind of do a small little bit of repair. And before they know it, they're kind of doing a kind of 50-page application form. They have public engagement. They have, all of these kind of community consultations, and they might just need a little bit of repair. And what I would love is for funders to realize that actually there is public benefit in just repairing a building, and you don't need all of the other bells and whistles. But also, I worry that because of the funding kind of landscape around all of this, that all of our historic church buildings are being pushed down a certain path. You know, they're all being pushed down towards a certain model that, you know, it almost seems like a church isn't worth having a future if it doesn't have a kind of toilet and a kettle anymore. And I think that's wrong. I think there should be different. I think responses to all of these places should be proportional to kind of, you know, their use and where they are.
It's interesting because you highlight some of the sort of failures or the weaknesses in the current policy environment for looking after churches like this. But it's clear, I mean, just alone from the Twitter account of the Friends of Friendless Churches, which I think you run, right? These are places that get a lot of people very emotionally engaged. These are places that a lot of people are interested in.
Yeah, I guess, you know, they're in many cases, they are really ancient places, kind of a real deep sense of continuity kind of to place. And, you know, one of the things that I love about churches, and definitely when I moved to England, one of the things that I love is that you can kind of rock up anywhere in the country and there will be a church and it will most likely be open. And it's one of the few spaces that you can kind of wander in, you know, poke around, photograph all their walls, sit in the pew. You know, I think they offer something that that no other kind of place in the community does offer. And I think for us, you know, all of our churches can be visited. And I think that people like the fact that they can have this space to themselves. You know, I think it's interesting, William, what you were saying, and definitely Shahid as well, about, you know, that kind of the the kind of kitting out of the spaces. Our churches are kind of quite stripped back, you know, because we don't inherit any of the fittings and, or, well, we do inherit the fittings, but kind of the soft furnishings and all these sorts of things. So they're quite, you know, they're quite simple and quite sparse inside. And I think people like that, because you can, the building kind of meets you on your own terms. There's nobody in there to kind of meet you and greet you and poke, you know, point out all the interesting things and give you a kind of a flyer asking if you want to come to the service on Sunday. That's absolutely fine if you want to. But the buildings are there, and you know, you can engage with them on your own terms. I think people value that.
The thing I found really quite moving about what Rachel was describing around these buildings was that idea of the inherentness of a sense of somewhere being sacred. Because I think William described these churches as embodiments of spiritual faith, but he also talked about the importance of people experiencing those spaces. And what Rachel was talking about is, does that idea of a sacred space persist when there isn't the community of ritual or practice there? And I think for me, she really convinced me that it does, actually, that these buildings have a sense of being sacred beyond the organized ritual of religion or of the communities that are there. She talks about that idea of the priority of preserving for future possible communities and possible uses. And just the final thing that she said that reminded me of something that Dawn Foster, who really tragically died recently, but she once talked about her faith and how it related to her politics. And she talked about churches as always being open and always being somewhere that you could go and sit without having to buy a cup of coffee or anything like that. And when Rachel described these unused churches in that same way as always being open and always being there to be a place that you could sit, that just felt so important. So I think that was a really fascinating perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can absolutely sympathise and feel very strongly that desire that, you know, there are churches everywhere in Britain, and the hope is that they can stay in some sense accessible, usable by the community and by people just visiting, that they become a tangible part of our heritage that we never lose. I think that's something that we can all hope for, regardless of the economic and social context in which that takes place. So yeah, thanks everyone so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this. If you did enjoy it, it would be really great if you could give us a review on your podcast app, because it helps other people to find the show. And also, if you have friends that are also interested in architecture, social history, related questions, do let them know by word of mouth. We've got all these amazing voices contributing to this project, and it would be amazing to have them heard by as many people as possible.
Absolutely. And don't forget as well, if you want to pursue your interest in architectural history, to look up the Society of Architectural Historians on our website. The details are at the end. And think about membership. We've got loads of great things that we offer our members.
Absolutely. Well, that's it for today, but you'll be hearing again from us soon. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.
Bye. This podcast has been produced by the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain, SAHGB. Established in 1956, we're the leading subject association for architectural history in the United Kingdom. Our educational mission is to promote architectural history inclusively to diverse audiences. Our mantra is all places, all periods, all welcome. We promote knowledge through learning, education, and research. We disseminate that knowledge through programming, content, and publications, and we advocate for the discipline and our members. To find out more about our work and to support our educational mission, please visit our website, sahgb.org.uk, or follow us at the SAHGB on Twitter or on Facebook. We are open to all. This podcast series has been created by Jessica Kelly, Matthew Lloyd Roberts, and Neil Sashaw. The series is produced by Frontier. To find out more about them, visit frontierpodcasts.com.